The priest turned to Lievin and said something that Lievin did not hear. "Take the bride's hand and lead her," said the best man. For a long time, Lievin could not be made to understand what he had to do, and they were a long while trying to set him right. Just as they were going to give it up, because he would either use the wrong hand or else take her by the wrong one, he at last comprehended that he, with his right hand, without changing his position, must take her by her right hand. When at last he had taken her hand properly, the priest went a few steps in front of them and halted at the lectern. The crowd of friends and relatives, their voices buzzing and the ladies' trains rustling, moved after them. Someone stooped down to arrange the bride's veil. The church became so quiet that the drops of wax were heard falling from the candles. The old priest, with his sacerdotal headgear and his locks of grey hair glistening like silver combed back behind his ears, drew his small old hands out from beneath his vestments of heavy silver cloth with a large gold cross on the back, and began turning over some pages on the lectern. Oblonsky stepped up cautiously, whispered something to him, made a sign to Lievin, and stepped back again. The priest lit two wax candles decorated with flowers, and holding them askew in his left hand so that the wax kept slowly dripping, turned to the young couple. It was the same priest who had heard Lievin's confession. He looked wearily and sadly at the bride and bridegroom, sighed, and disengaging his right hand from the vestments, held it up in blessing over the bridegroom and then over the bride. Only in his manner when he placed his fingers on Kitty's bowed head there was a shade of tenderness. Then he gave them the candles, took the censer, and slowly stepped away from them. "Is it really true?" thought Lievin, and glanced round at his bride. He could see her profile slightly from above, and by the just perceptible movements of her lips and eyelashes he knew she was aware of his look. She did not turn, but her high frilled collar moved, rising to her pink little ear. He saw that a sigh had been suppressed within her breast, and that the little hand in its long glove holding the candle trembled. All the worry about his shirt, his lateness, the conversation of their relatives, their displeasure at his ridiculous mishap, suddenly vanished from his mind, and he felt happy, though scared. The handsome, tall senior deacon in a silver cloth alb, his curled hair parted down the middle, came briskly forward, lifting his stole with a practiced movement of two fingers, and stopped opposite the priest. "Bless us, Lord," slowly succeeding one another and vibratingly resonant, came the solemn tones.
"Blessed be our God, now and hereafter, for ever and ever," replied the old priest meekly in a sing-song voice, continuing to turn something over on the lectern. Then, harmoniously filling the whole church from windows to vaulted roof, a full chord sung by the invisible choir rose, swelled, hung for a moment, and softly died away. There were prayers, as usual, for the world above, for salvation, for the synod, for the emperor, and also for the servants of God that day wedded, Constantine and Catherine.
"Let us pray to the Lord that he may send them perfect love, peace, and help."
The whole church seemed to breathe with the senior deacon's voice. Lievin listened to the words and was struck by them. "How did they find out that it is help, exactly help, that I need?" he wondered, remembering his late fears and doubts. "What do I know? What can I do in this awful matter without help? Help is exactly what I need now." When the deacon had finished the prayer for the imperial family, the priest, holding a book, turned to the bride and bridegroom.
"Eternal God, who joinest them that were separate," he read in his mild, sing-song voice, "and hast ordained for them an indissoluble union in love, thou who didst bless Isaac and Rebecca, and hast kept thy promise to their heirs, bless these thy servants, Constantine and Catherine, and lead them on the path of righteousness. Most merciful God, lover of man, we praise thee. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost, now and hereafter, and for ever and ever. Amen, from the invisible choir, again floated through the air.
Joinest them that were separate. What a depth of meaning is in those words, and how well they fit in with what I am feeling at this moment, thought Lievin. Does she feel the same?
Looking round, he met her eyes. From the expression in them, he concluded that she understood them as he did. But this was not so. She understood hardly anything of the service, and was not even listening to the words of the ceremony. She could neither listen nor understand. So deep was the one feeling that filled her soul and became ever stronger and stronger. It was a feeling of joy at the fruition of what had been for the last month and a half going on in her soul, of that which for those 6 weeks had gladdened and tortured her. On the day when, in the ballroom of the house in Arbat Street, she in her brown dress had gone up to him and silently plighted herself to him, on that day and in that hour, a complete rupture seemed to have taken place within her soul between her former life and this other new and entirely unknown life, although in fact the old life still went on. Those 6 weeks had been the most blissful and at the same time the most trying of her life. The whole of her life, all her desires and hopes, were concentrated on this one man, still incomprehensible to her, to whom she was bound by a feeling even more incomprehensible than the man himself, which now attracted and now repelled her. Meantime, she went on living under the conditions of her old life and was horrified at herself, at her utter and unconquerable indifference to all her past, the things, habits, and people who had loved and still loved her, to her mother, who was hurt by her indifference, to her dear, affectionate father, whom she had previously loved more than anyone else on earth. At one moment she was horrified at this indifference, and the next moment rejoiced at that which caused her indifference. She could not think of or desire anything but life with this man, but as that life had not yet begun, she could not even clearly picture it to herself. There was only anticipation, fear, and joy at something new and unknown. And now, at any moment, the anticipation and uncertainty and the remorse at repudiating her former life would all come to an end and something new would begin. This new life could not help being terrible in consequence of its incertitude. But terrible or not, it was already an accomplished fact within her soul 6 weeks ago, and was now only being sanctified. Again turning to the reading desk, the priest with some difficulty picked up Kitty's little ring, and asking Lievin for his hand, put the ring on the tip of his finger.
The servant of God, Constantine, is betrothed to the servant of God, Catherine.
And having put a big ring on Kitty's slender, rosy finger, pathetic in its weakness, the priest repeated the same words. Several times the couple tried to guess what was expected of them, and blundered each time, the priest prompting them in whispers. When what was necessary had at length been complied with, he made the sign of the cross over them with the rings, and again gave the larger one to Kitty and the little one to Lievin. And again they blundered and passed the rings twice backwards and forwards without doing what was necessary. Dolly, Chirikov, and Oblonsky came forward to help them. The result was some confusion, whispering, and smiles, but the expression of solemn emotion on the young couple's faces did not change. On the contrary, while they fumbled with their hands, they looked even more solemn and serious than before, and the smile with which Oblonsky whispered to them to put on their rings involuntarily died on his lips. He felt that any kind of smile would hurt their feelings.
"Thou hast from the beginning created them male and female,"
read the priest when they had exchanged rings. Through thee the wife is knit to the husband for a helpmeet and to procreate the human race. Therefore, O God our Lord, who sentest down thy truth upon thy heritage and gavest thy promises to our fathers from generation to generation of thy chosen people, look down upon thy servant Constantine and thy servant Catherine, and strengthen them in their union with faith and concord in truth and love. Levin felt more and more that his ideas of marriage and his dreams of how he would arrange his life had been but childishness, and that this was something he had never understood, and was now still further from understanding, although it was happening to him. And in his breast a tremor rose, higher and higher, and the unruly tears came to his eyes. Chapter 5. All Moscow, including both relatives and friends, had congregated in the church. During the marriage ceremony, in the brilliantly illuminated building, among the crowd of elegantly dressed women and girls and men in evening dress with white ties, or in uniform, conversation in the low tones required by propriety never flagged. It was usually started by the men, for the women were absorbed in watching every detail of the service, which always fascinates them. In the circle nearest the bride were her two sisters, Dolly, the elder, and the calm and beautiful Princess Lvova, who had come from abroad.
"Why is Marie in lilac? It's almost as unsuitable at a wedding as black," remarked Mrs. Korsunskaya.
"With her complexion, it's her only salvation," replied Princess Trubetskaya.
"I wonder they are having the wedding in the evening, like tradespeople."
"It is more showy." "I was married in the evening, too," answered Mrs. Korsunskaya, and sighed as she remembered how sweet she had looked that day, how funnily enamoured her husband then was, and how different things were now.
"They say that one who has been best man more than 10 times never marries, and I wanted to be one for the 10th time to make myself safe, but was too late,"
Count Sinyavin was saying to the pretty young Princess Charskaya, who had designs on him. She answered only with a smile. She was looking at Kitty, and thinking of the time when she would be standing there beside Count Sinyavin, just as Kitty now stood, and how she would then remind him of his joke. Young Shcherbatsky told the old maid of honour, Nikolaeva, that he intended to put the crown on Kitty's chignon to make her happy.
"One ought not to wear a chignon," replied the maid of honour, who had long ago made up her mind that if the old widower for whom she was angling ever married her, their wedding should be of the simplest.
Koznishev was talking to Dolly, jokingly assuring her that the custom of going away after the wedding was spreading because newly married couples always felt rather uncomfortable.
"Your brother has a right to feel proud. She is wonderfully sweet. You must be feeling envious."
"I am past all that, Darya Alexandrovna," he answered,
and his face became unexpectedly sad and serious. Oblonsky was telling his sister-in-law the pun he had made about dissolving marriages.
"I must put her wreath straight," she replied, without listening.
"What a pity she has grown so much plainer," remarked Countess Nordston to the Princess Lvova. "All the same, he is not worth her little finger. Don't you agree?"
"No, I like him very much, and not just because he will be my brother-in-law," answered the princess.
"How well he behaves. And it is so difficult to behave well under these circumstances and not be ridiculous. And he is not ridiculous or stiff, and is evidently touched."
"I suppose you quite expected this."
"Almost. She always liked him."
"Well, let us see which of them will step first on the mat. I have given Kitty my advice."
"It does not matter," replied Princess Lvova.
"We are all submissive wives. It is in our nature."
"Well, I stepped on the mat before Vasily."
"And you, Dolly?"
Dolly, who was standing near, heard but did not reply. Her eyes were moist,
and she could not have spoken without bursting into tears. She rejoiced at the sight of Kitty and Lievin, but going back to the past, she thought of her own wedding, kept glancing at the beaming Oblonsky, and, forgetting the present, recollected nothing but her own young and innocent love. She remembered not herself only, but all the women with whom she was intimate or acquainted, thought of them as they had been at that most solemn moment of their lives when, like Kitty, they had stood beneath the nuptial crown with love, hope, and fear in their hearts, renouncing the past and entering upon the mystic future. Among the brides that came to her mind was her dear Anna, about whose impending divorce she had heard a while ago. She too had once stood with veiled head, pure and crowned with orange blossom. "And now? How strange," she murmured. All the details of the ceremony were followed not only by the two sisters, the friends and relatives, but also by women onlookers who were quite strangers and who, breathless with excitement and afraid of missing anything, even a single movement or expression of the bride's or bridegroom's face, and annoyed by the indifference of the men, did not answer, and indeed often did not hear the latter when they jested or made irrelevant remarks. "Why is her face so tear-stained? She being married against her will?" "Against her will, indeed, to such a fine fellow. Is he a prince? And is that her sister in white satin? Now, hear how the deacon will roar, 'Wives, obey your husbands!' Is it the Chudovsky choir?"
"No, the synods."
"I asked the footman. It seems he will take her to his estate, straight off."
"He's dreadfully rich, they say. That's why they have given her to him."
"Oh, no, they're a very nice couple." "There now, Maria Vasilievna, you were maintaining that crinolines were being worn fuller at the back. Just look at that one in the puce dress, an ambassador's wife, they say. See how it's draped this way and back again." "What a darling the bride is, like a lamb decked for the slaughter. But, whatever you may say, one does feel sorry for a girl."
So chattered the crowd of women who had managed to get inside the church. Chapter 6. When the first part of the ceremony was over, a verger spread out a piece of pink silk cloth in front of the lectern. The choir began singing a psalm to some elaborate and complicated melody in which the bass and tenor continually repeated each other, and the priest, turning round, motioned the couple to the piece of pink silk. Often as they had heard the saying that the one who stepped first on the mat would be head of the household, neither Lievin nor Kitty could think of that as they took those few steps, nor did they hear the loud remarks and disputes of those who maintained that he was first, and of others who said that they did it both together. After the usual questions of whether they wished to be married and whether they had promised themselves to others and their answers, which sounded strange to themselves, the second part of the service began. Kitty listened to the words of the prayer, trying to comprehend their meaning, but unable to do so. Triumph and radiant joy filled her heart more and more as the ceremony proceeded and made it impossible for her to be attentive. They prayed that they may live in chastity for the good of the fruits of the womb and find joy in their sons and daughters. It was declared that God had created woman from Adam's rib, and that, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh," and that, "This is a great mystery." They prayed that God should make them fruitful and bless them as he blessed Isaac and Rebekah, Joseph, Moses, and Zipporah, and that they should see their children's children.
"It is all very beautiful," thought Kitty as she heard these words, "and could not be different."
And a smile of joy, which involuntarily communicated itself to all who regarded her, shone on her radiant face.
"Put it quite on,"
came the words of advice when the priest had put crowns on their heads, and Shcherbatsky, his hand in its three-buttoned glove, trembling, held the crown high above Kitty's head.
"Put it on,"
she whispered, smiling. Levin glanced round at her, was struck by the joyous radiance of her face, and was involuntarily infected by her feeling. He felt bright and joyous as she did. With light hearts they heard the epistle read, and the roll of the senior deacon's voice in the last verse, for which the outsiders present had been waiting impatiently. With light hearts they drank the warm wine and water from the shallow cup, and their spirits rose still higher when the priest, throwing back his vestments, took their hands in his and led them round the lectern while a bass voice sang, "Rejoice, O Isaiah!" Young Shcherbatsky and Chirikov, who were supporting the crowns and getting entangled in the bride's train, smiled too, and were pleased without knowing why, when they chanced to lag behind or jostle the young couple if the priest happened to stop. The spark of joy that was glowing in Kitty's heart seemed to have spread to everyone in the church. Levin fancied that the priest and deacon wanted to smile just as he did. Having lifted the crowns from their heads, the priest read the last prayer and congratulated the married couple. Levin glanced at Kitty and thought he had never seen her like that before, so enchanting with the new light of happiness irradiating her face. He wished to speak to her, but did not know whether it was all over yet. The priest helped him out of the difficulty, saying softly, with a smile on his kindly mouth, "Kiss your wife, and you kiss your husband." He took the candles from their hands. Levin kissed her carefully on her smiling lips, offered his arm, and with a feeling of strange closeness led her out of the church. He could not believe it was all true, and only realized it when their surprised and timid glances met, and he felt that they were already one. After supper that same night, the young couple left for the country. Chapter 7. Vronsky and Anna had already been traveling together in Europe for 3 months. They had visited Venice, Rome, and Naples, and had only just reached a small Italian town where they meant to make a longer stay. A handsome head waiter, his thick hair greased with pomatum and parted from the nape upward, dressed in a swallowtail coat with a wide lawn shirt front and a bundle of charms dangling on his rotund stomach, with his hands in his pockets, his eyes screwed up contemptuously, was answering a bystander's questions in a severe tone. Hearing steps ascending the stairs at the other side of the entrance, the waiter turned and recognized the Russian count who occupied the best rooms in the hotel. He respectfully took his hands out of his pockets, bowed, and said that the courier had been, and that the business of renting the palazzo was settled. The steward was ready to sign the contract.
"Ah, I am very glad," said Vronsky. "And is the lady in?"
"The lady has been for a walk, but has now returned," replied the waiter. Vronsky took off his soft, broad-brimmed hat and wiped his perspiring forehead and his hair, which he had allowed to grow halfway down his ears and wore brushed back so as to hide his bald patch. After an absent-minded glance at the man who was still standing there watching him, he was about to go in.
"This gentleman is a Russian and was asking about you," said the head waiter.
With a mixture of vexation at the impossibility of evading his acquaintances anywhere, and of desire to find something to distract the monotony of his life, Vronsky looked round again at the man, who had first moved away and then halted, and at the same moment the eyes of both brightened.
"Golenishev! Vronsky!"
It was really Golenishev, his fellow student in the Corps des Pages. In the Corps, Golenishev had been a liberal, had left the Corps a civilian, and had never served. On leaving the Corps, the two friends had separated, and had met but once since then. On that occasion, Vronsky found that Golenishev had chosen some high-flown liberal activity, and therefore felt he must despise Vronsky's profession and activities. Consequently, Vronsky had then treated him with the cold, proud aloofness of which he was master, which meant, "You may like or dislike my way of life,
It is a matter of absolute indifference to me, but if you wish to know me, you must respect me." And Golenishtchev had remained contemptuously indifferent to Vronsky's attitude, so that that meeting ought to have separated them still further. Yet now they brightened up and exclaimed with pleasure at recognizing one another. Vronsky would never have thought he could be so pleased to see Golenishtchev, but probably he was himself unaware how bored he was. He forgot the unpleasant impression left by their last encounter, and with an open and joyful countenance held out his hand to his old schoolfellow. A similar expression of pleasure replaced the former anxious look on Golenishtchev's face. "How pleased I am to see you," said Vronsky, a friendly smile disclosing his fine white teeth.
"I heard the name of Vronsky, but I did not know which Vronsky. I am very, very pleased."
"Come in." "Well, and what are you doing?"
"Oh, I have been here over a year. I am working."
"Ah?" said Vronsky, in an interested tone.
"Well, come in."
And according to the usual way with Russians, instead of saying what he wanted to hide from the servants in Russian, he began speaking French.
"You know Madame Karenina? We are travelling together. I am now going to her," he said in French, attentively watching Golenishtchev's expression.
"Ah, I did not know," Golenishtchev replied in a tone of indifference, though he was quite aware of it.
"Been here long?" he added.
"I?"
3 days,
answered Vronsky, still attentively scrutinizing his friend's face.
"Yes, he is a decent fellow and looks at the matter in the right way," said Vronsky to himself, understanding the meaning of the other's look and the change of subject. "I can introduce him to Anna as he sees the matter rightly."
During the 3 months he had spent abroad with Anna, Vronsky, when coming across new people, had always asked himself how the new person would be likely to regard his relations with Anna, and in most cases he had found that the men he met understood it in the right way. But had he, and those who understood the matter in the right way, been asked what this understanding amounted to, they would have been much puzzled how to reply. At bottom, those who, in Vronsky's opinion, understood it the right way did not understand it in any special way, but behaved in general as well-bred persons do with regard to all the complicated and unanswerable problems which surround life on every side. They conducted themselves properly, avoiding insinuations and inconvenient questions. They pretended to understand completely the significance and meaning of the situation, to countenance and even approve of it, but to consider it out of place and unnecessary to explain all this. Vronsky at once guessed that Golenishtchev was one of that sort, and therefore doubly pleased to have met him. And Golenishtchev behaved to Anna, when he had been introduced, as well as Vronsky could have wished. Evidently he avoided, without the least effort, everything in conversation that might have sounded awkward. He had never met Anna before, and was struck by her beauty, and still more by the simplicity with which she accepted her position. She blushed when Vronsky showed Golenishtchev in, and the childlike flush that suffused her open and handsome face pleased him exceedingly. But what pleased him most was that at once, and apparently intentionally to prevent any possibility of misapprehension in the stranger's mind, she called Vronsky simply Alexei, and said that they were about to move into a house of their own called a palazzo, which they had just taken. This straightforward and simple attitude toward her own position pleased Golenishtchev. Noticing Anna's good-natured, bright and energetic manner, he thought that, knowing both Karenin and Vronsky as he did, he quite understood her. He thought he understood what she herself was quite unable to understand, how, though she was the cause of her husband's unhappiness and had abandoned him and her son and lost her own good name, she could feel energetic, cheerful and happy. "It is mentioned in the guidebook," said Golenishtchev, referring to the palazzo Vronsky was taking. "There is a fine Tintoretto there, one of his later period." "I say, the weather is glorious. Let us go and have another look at it," said Vronsky to Anna.
"I should like to very much. I'll just go and put on my hat. You say it's hot?" she asked, stopping at the door, and looking inquiringly at Vronsky while a bright flush again suffused her face.
From her look, Vronsky understood that she did not yet know what attitude he wished to adopt toward Golenishtchev, and was afraid she might not have behaved suitably. He answered with a long and tender look.
"No, not very hot," he said.
She thought she had understood him completely, and above all that he was satisfied with her. She gave him a smile and went out with rapid steps. The two friends looked at each other, and in both faces appeared an embarrassed expression, as if Golenishev, who obviously admired her, tried but failed to hit on the right thing to say about her, and as if Vronsky both feared and wished that he should succeed.
"Well, and so you've settled down here," said Vronsky, in order to begin a conversation. "You are still busy at the same thing?" he went on, recollecting that he had heard the other was writing something. "Yes, I am writing the second part of Two Principles," said Golenishev, flushing with pleasure at the question. "To be quite exact, I mean, I'm not yet writing, but am collecting the materials. The book will be much fuller and will deal with almost all the questions. We in Russia are slow to realize that we are the inheritors of Byzantium." And he began a long and heated explanation. At first, Vronsky felt uncomfortable because he did not know even the first part of Two Principles, which the author mentioned as if it were well known. But later on, when Golenishev began expounding his view and Vronsky was able to follow him, even though he was ignorant of Two Principles, he listened with interest, for the man talked well. Yet Vronsky was surprised at and sorry to see the irritable excitement with which Golenishev spoke on the subject that interested him. The longer he talked, the more his eyes flashed, the more hastily he retorted on imaginary opponents, and the more agitated and offended became his face. Remembering him as a thin, active, good-natured and noble boy, always at the head of his class, Vronsky could not understand the cause of the agitation, nor approve of it. What most displeased him was that Golenishev, a man belonging to good society, should put himself on the same level with certain scribblers who irritated him and made him angry. Was it worthwhile? He did not like this, but nevertheless he felt that Golenishev was not happy, and he was sorry for him. Signs of distress, of insanity almost, were apparent in his mobile and rather good-natured face when, without even observing that Anna had re-entered the room, he continued expressing his views with haste and warmth. When Anna returned with her hat and mantle on, and stood beside him, toying with her sunshade with quick motions of her beautiful hand, Vronsky, with a feeling of relief, turned from Golenishev's eyes, which were fixed on him plaintively. With renewed love, he glanced at his charming companion, so full of vitality and joy. With an effort, Golenishev recollected himself, but he was at first dejected and morose. Anna, however, who at that time was amiably disposed to everyone, soon revived him by her simple and cheerful behaviour. After trying several topics of conversation, she led him on to the subject of art, about which he talked very well and listened to him with attention. They walked to the house they had taken and looked over it. "I am very pleased about one thing," said Anna to Golenishev when they had returned to the hotel. "Alexei will have a nice studio. You must certainly have that room, Alexei," she added, having understood that Golenishev was to be on an intimate footing with them, and that there was no need to pretend in his presence. "Do you paint?" inquired Golenishev, turning quickly to Vronsky. "Yes, I went in for it long ago, and now have begun a little," answered Vronsky with a blush. "He is very talented," said Anna with a pleased smile. "Of course, I am no judge, but people who do know say so."
Chapter 8. During this, the first period of her freedom and rapid recovery, Anna was unpardonably happy and full of the joy of life. The memory of her husband's grief did not poison her happiness. On the one hand, this memory was too terrible to dwell upon, and on the other hand, her husband's misfortune had meant for her too great a joy for repentance to be possible. The recollection of all that had happened to her since her illness, her reconciliation with her husband, the rupture, the news of Vronsky's wound, his reappearance in her husband's house, the preparations for divorce, the parting from her home and son, all now seemed a delirious dream from which she had wakened abroad and alone with Vronsky. The memory of the evil done to her husband aroused in her a feeling akin to repulsion,
such as a man might feel who, when in danger of drowning, had shaken off another who clung to him. That other was drowned. Of course, it was wrong. But it had been the only way of escape, and it was better not to recall such terrible details. One comforting reflection about her conduct had come to her in the first moment of the rupture, and when she now remembered the past, she also recalled that reflection. "I was the inevitable cause of unhappiness to him," she thought. "But I don't wish to profit by his calamity. I too am suffering, and must suffer. I am losing what I most cherished, my good name and my son. I have done wrong, and therefore do not ask for happiness, and do not want a divorce. I must go on suffering from the degradation, and by the separation from my son." But sincerely as Anna desired to suffer, she was not suffering. She was not conscious of degradation. With the tact they both possessed, and by avoiding Russian ladies abroad, the two never placed themselves in a false position, and always met people who pretended to understand their mutual relations much better than they themselves understood them. The parting from her son, whom she loved, did not trouble her at first, either. The little girl, his child, was so sweet, and Anna had grown so attached to her since she was the only child left to her, that she rarely thought of her son. The desire to live, enhanced by her recovery, was so powerful, and the conditions of her life were so novel and pleasant, that Anna felt unpardonably happy. The better she knew Vronsky, the more she loved him. She loved him both for his own sake and for his love of her. To possess him entirely was a continual joy to her. His nearness was always pleasant. All the traits of character with which she became better and better acquainted seemed inexpressibly delightful. His appearance, altered by civilian dress, was as attractive to her as to a girl in love. In all he said, thought, or did, she saw something peculiarly noble and exalted. She herself was frightened at the rapture with which he inspired her. She sought, but could not find, anything in him that was not beautiful. She dared not let him see her consciousness of her own inferiority. To her it seemed that if he knew of it, he would the sooner cease to love her, and there was nothing she now feared more, though she had no reason to do so, than the loss of his love. But she could not help being grateful to him for his treatment of her, and showing him how much she valued it. He, who in her opinion had such a decided vocation for statesmanship, in which he ought to have played a conspicuous part, had sacrificed his ambitions for her, and never showed the least regret. He was even more lovingly respectful to her than before, and the thought that she must never be allowed to feel the awkwardness of her situation never left his mind for a moment. He, so virile a man, not only never contradicted her, but where she was concerned, seemed to have no will of his own, and to be only occupied in anticipating her every wish. She could not help appreciating this, although his strained attentiveness, the atmosphere of solicitude with which she surrounded her, became burdensome at times. Vronsky, meanwhile, in spite of the complete fulfillment of what he had so long desired, was not completely happy. He soon felt that the realization of his longing gave him only one grain of the mountain of bliss he had anticipated. That realization showed him the eternal error men make by imagining that happiness consists in the gratification of their wishes. When first he united his life with hers and donned civilian clothes, he felt the delight of freedom in general such as he had not before known, and also the freedom of love. He was contented then, but not for long. Soon he felt rising in his soul a desire for desires. Boredom. Involuntarily, he began to snatch at every passing caprice, mistaking it for a desire and a purpose. 16 hours daily had to be filled somehow, living abroad as they did, completely at liberty, quite cut off from the round of social life that had filled his time in Petersburg.
The pleasures of a bachelor's life, enjoyed by him on his previous travels abroad, were not to be thought of now, for one attempt of that kind had produced in Anna an unexpected fit of depression, quite disproportionate to the offence of a late supper with some acquaintances. Intercourse with local society, or with the Russians, was, in consequence of the indefiniteness of their relation, likewise impossible. Sightseeing, apart from the fact that he had already seen everything, had for him, a Russian and an intelligent man, none of that inexplicable importance the English managed to attach to it. As a hungry animal seizes every object it meets, hoping to find food in it, so Vronsky unconsciously seized now on politics, now on new books, now on pictures. As in his youth he had shown aptitude for art, and not knowing how to spend his money had begun to collect engravings, he now settled down to painting and began to work at it, putting into it the surplus stock of desire which demanded satisfaction. He had a talent for understanding art and for imitating it with accuracy and good taste, and he imagined that he possessed the real power an artist needs. After wavering for some time between various kinds of art, religious, historical, genre, or realistic, he began to paint. He understood all the different kinds and was able to draw inspiration from all, but he could not imagine that it is possible to be quite ignorant of the different kinds of art and to be inspired directly by what is in one's own soul, regardless of whether what one paints belongs to any particular school. As he did not know this and was not inspired directly by life, but indirectly by life already embodied in art, he found inspiration very readily and easily, and equally readily and easily produced paintings very similar to the school of art he wished to imitate. He liked the graceful and effective French school of painting best, and in that style began painting a portrait of Anna dressed as an Italian, and he, as well as everyone else who saw it, considered the portrait a great success.
Chapter 9. The neglected old palazzo, with its high stucco ceilings, its wall frescoes and mosaic floors, with heavy yellow damask hangings at the big windows, vases standing on brackets and mantel shelves, carved doors and sombre halls filled with pictures. That palazzo, when they had moved into it, by its very appearance kept alive in Vronsky the pleasant delusion that he was not so much a Russian landowner and equerry without a post, as an enlightened connoisseur and art patron, and withal a modest artist himself, who had renounced the world, his connections and ambitions, for the sake of the woman he loved. The role Vronsky had chosen with their removal to the palazzo was quite successful, and having through Golenishev made the acquaintance of several interesting persons, he felt tranquil for a time. He painted studies from nature under the direction of an Italian professor and studied Italian life in the Middle Ages. Medieval Italian life had at that time become so fascinating to him that he even began to wear his hat and throw his cloak across his shoulder in a medieval manner which was very becoming to him. "Here we live and know nothing," said Vronsky one morning to Golenishev, who had come to see him. "Have you seen Mikhailov's picture?" And he passed his visitor a Russian newspaper that had just arrived and pointed to an article on a Russian artist who was living in that town and had just finished a picture long talked of and bought before completion. The article reproached the government and the academy for leaving a remarkable artist without encouragement or help. "I have," answered Golenishev. "Of course, he is not without talent, but his tendency is quite a false one. He has that Ivanov-Strauss-Renan attitude toward Christ and religious art."
"What is the subject of his picture?" asked Anna.
"Christ before Pilate. Christ is pictured as a Jew with all the realism of the new school." Led on by this question about the subject of the picture to one of his favourite topics, he began to explain.
"I can't understand how one can make so gross an error. In the art of the old masters, Christ was given a definite embodiment. Therefore, if they want to depict not God but a revolutionary or a sage, let them choose some historic character. Socrates, Franklin, Charlotte Corday, but certainly not Christ. They choose the one person who must not be chosen as a subject for art, and then—"
"And is it true that this Mikhailov is so poor?"
inquired Vronsky, thinking that he, as a Russian Maecenas, ought to help this artist regardless of whether his picture was good or bad.
Hardly. He's a wonderful portrait painter.
Have you seen his portrait of Vasilchikova? But it seems he does not want to paint any more portraits, so it is possible he may be in want. I say that...
Couldn't one ask him to paint Anna Arkadyevna's portrait? Said Vronsky.
Why mine? Said Anna. After the one you painted, I want no other. Better have one of Annie, as she called her little girl. Oh, there she is, she added, looking from the window at the beautiful Italian nurse who had taken the baby into the garden, and then immediately glancing round at Vronsky. The beautiful nurse, whose head Vronsky was painting for his picture, was the only and secret sorrow of Anna's life. Vronsky painted her, admired her beauty and her medievalness, and Anna dared not confess to herself that she was afraid of being jealous of the nurse. So she treated the woman with special kindness and spoiled her and her little son. Vronsky, too, looked out of the window and into Anna's eyes and at once turned to Golenishev, saying,
Do you know this Mikhailov?
I have met him, but he is a crank and quite uneducated.
You know, he is one of those heathenish new folk one so often meets nowadays.
You know, one of those free thinkers who have been brought up from the beginning in disbelief, negation, and materialism. Formerly, Golenishev went on, either not noticing or not wishing to notice that both Anna and Vronsky wanted to speak, formerly a free thinker was a man brought up with ideas of religion, law, and morality, who himself, through struggle and pain, had attained freedom of thought. But now a new type of born free thinkers has appeared. These grow up without so much as hearing that there used to be laws of morality and religion, and that there was once authority in these things. They grow up simply with the idea of negation, that is, as heathens.
He is one of these.
He is the son of a head footman, I think, and has had no education. When he entered the academy and won a reputation for himself, he, not being stupid, wanted to get some education. So he resorted to what seemed to him to be the wellspring of education, the magazines. You see, formerly a man who wished to get an education, a Frenchman, let us say, would have commenced studying all the classics, theologians, dramatists, historians, and philosophers, and with what mental labour he would have been confronted. But among us at the present day, he tumbled straight into the literature of negation and rapidly assimilated the essence of the negative teaching, and there he was. And that is not all. 20 years ago, he would have found in that kind of literature signs of the struggle with authority and of an outlook centuries old, and from that struggle would have deduced that something else had existed. But as it is, he stumbles on a kind of literature that does not even deign to dispute the old point of view, saying straight off, there is nothing but evolution, selection, the struggle for existence, and nothing more. In my article, Do you know what we'll do? Cried Anna, who for some time had been furtively exchanging looks with Vronsky and knew that the latter was not at all interested in the education of the artist, but was only concerned to help him by giving him a commission for a portrait. "'Do you know what we'll do?' she resolutely interrupted Golenishev, who was in the full flow of his speech. "'Let us go and see him.' Golenishev pulled himself up and unwillingly agreed. But as the artist lived in a distant part of the town, they decided to hire a carriage. An hour later, Anna, seated beside Golenishev, with Vronsky facing them, drove to a new, ugly house in a distant quarter of the town. Having learnt from the house porter's wife, who came out to meet them, that Mikhailov allowed visitors into his studio, but was at that moment at his lodgings a few steps away, they sent her with their cards to beg permission to see his pictures. Chapter 10 Mikhailov, the artist, was at work as usual when Vronsky's and Golenishev's cards were brought him. Every morning he worked in the studio at his big picture. On returning home, he had been angry with his wife because she had not managed to pacify the landlady, who clamoured for the rent.
"'Have I not told you scores of times not to enter upon discussions? At best you're only a fool, and when you begin arguing in Italian you become a treble fool,' he said at the end of a long dispute. Then you shouldn't get into arrears. It's not my fault. If I had any money...
Shut up, for heaven's sake!
Cried Mikhailov, with tears in his voice, stopping his ears with his hands as he went into his workroom behind a partition and locked the door behind him.
What a duffer!
He muttered to himself as he seated himself at the table. And having opened a portfolio, he at once set to work with particular ardour at an unfinished drawing. He never worked with such ardour or so successfully as when things were going badly with him, and especially after a quarrel with his wife.
Oh, dear, if only I could escape somewhere, he thought as he worked.
He was sketching the figure of a man in a fit of anger. He had sketched him before, but had been dissatisfied with the result.
The other one was better. Where is it?
He went back to his wife, and frowning, without looking at her, asked his eldest little girl where the paper was that he had given them. The paper with the drawing that he had thrown away was found, but it was dirty now and spotted with candle grease. Nevertheless, he took it, put it on his table, and stepping backward and screwing up his eyes, began examining it. Suddenly, he smiled and flung up his arms joyfully.
"That's it! That's it!" he said,
and taking up his pencil, he began drawing rapidly. A grease spot had given the figure a new pose. He copied that new pose, and, suddenly remembering the energetic pose and prominent chin of a shopman from whom he had bought cigars, he gave the figure that man's face and chin. He laughed with joy, for the inanimate, unnatural figure had become alive and was just the thing. The figure was alive, clear, and well-defined. It was possible to correct the drawing to accord with the requirements of the pose. It was possible, and even necessary, to place the feet further apart, to alter the position of the left arm, and to throw back the hair. But while making these corrections, he did not alter the pose, but only removed what interfered with its character. He removed, if one may say so, the coverings which partially obscured the figure, every fresh stroke making its energy and power more apparent, and more as it had been suddenly revealed to him by the effects of the grease spot. He was carefully finishing the drawing when the cards were brought to him.
Directly, directly!
He went out to his wife.
Come, Sasha, don't be angry, he said, smiling, timidly and tenderly. You were wrong, and so was I.
I'll settle it all.
Having made it up with his wife, he put on an olive-green overcoat with a velvet collar and a hat and went to the studio. His successful drawing was already forgotten. Now he was pleased and excited by the visit to his studio of these grand Russians who had come in a carriage. About his picture, the one at present on the easel, he had at the bottom of his heart a firm opinion that no one had ever painted anything like it. He did not consider his picture better than all Raphael's, but he knew that what he wanted to express in that picture had never yet been expressed by anyone. Of that he was firmly convinced, and had long been so ever since he had begun painting it. Yet the opinion of others, whoever they might be, seemed to him of great importance, and disturbed him to the depths of his soul. Every remark, even the most trivial, which showed that those who judged it saw even but a small part of what he himself saw in it, moved him deeply. He always attributed to those judges a better understanding than his own, and always expected to hear from them something he had himself not noticed in his work, often fancying that in their criticisms he had really found that something. With rapid steps he approached the door of his studio, and in spite of his excitement was struck by the soft light on Anna's figure as she stood in the shadow of the porch listening to something Golenishev was vehemently saying, and at the same time evidently wishing to look at the approaching artist. He was himself unconscious that as he approached them, he seized and absorbed this impression, just as he had retained the tobacconist's chin and hidden it away where he could find it when it was wanted. The visitors, already disenchanted by Golenishev's account of the artist, were still further disillusioned by his appearance. Of medium height, thick set, and with a loose gait, Mikhailov, in his brown hat, olive-green overcoat, and narrow trousers, at a time when wide ones had long since come into fashion,
and especially his commonplace broad face, expressing a combination of timidity and a desire to be dignified, created an unpleasant impression.
"Come in, please,"
he said, trying to put on an air of indifference, as he entered the hall and took a key from his pocket to unlock the door. Chapter 11. On entering his studio, the artist again cast a glance at his visitors and took note of Vronsky's face, especially his jaw. Although his artistic perceptions never slept, and although he was growing more and more excited as the moment approached when his picture was to be criticized, he quickly and shrewdly, from imperceptible data, formed his opinion of these three persons. Of Golenishev, he thought, "That one is a Russian who lives here." Mikhailov did not remember his name, or where he had seen him, or what they had talked about. He remembered only his face, as he remembered every face he had ever seen. But he also remembered that it was one of the faces he had mentally put aside with the enormous class of falsely important faces, faces lacking expression. A mass of hair and a very open forehead gave a superficial significance to that face, which had an insignificant, childish, restless expression concentrated in the narrow bridge of the nose. Vronsky and Anna, according to Mikhailov's conception, were in all probability distinguished, wealthy Russians, who, like all these wealthy Russians, comprehended nothing of art, but pretended to be amateurs and critics.
"Probably they've seen all the antiquities and are now going the round of the modern painters, the German quack and the stupid English Pre-Raphaelite, and to complete the series have come to see me, too," he thought. Well, he knew the dilettante's way of examining the studios of modern artists. The cleverer they were, the worse they were, with the one purpose of being able to say afterwards that art had deteriorated, and that the more modern art one sees, the more evident it becomes that the old masters were inimitable. He expected all this, saw it in their faces, in the careless indifference with which they talked among themselves, looked at the lay figures and busts, and unconcernedly walked about while waiting for him to uncover his picture. But in spite of all this, as he turned over his studies, pulled up the blinds, and withdrew the sheet from his picture, he felt very excited. All the more so because, though he regarded distinguished and wealthy Russians as mostly beasts and fools, Vronsky, and especially Anna, pleased him.
"There," he said, stepping aside with his loose gait and pointing to the picture. "This is Pilate's admonition, Matthew chapter 27, he went on, conscious that his lips were beginning to tremble with excitement, and he stepped behind the visitors. During the few moments that they were silently gazing at it, Mikhailov also regarded it with the indifferent eye of a stranger. In those few moments, he believed in advance that the highest and justest of criticisms was going to be pronounced by these very visitors whom he had so despised a moment before. He forgot all that he had thought of his picture during the 3 years that he had worked at it, forgot all its merits, which he had not doubted, and saw it from the fresh point of view of an indifferent stranger. And he saw nothing good in it. He saw in the foreground Pilate's vexed face, and Christ's calm one, and behind them the faces of Pilate's servants and of John watching what was taking place. Each of those faces that with so much searching, so many faults and corrections, he had evolved with its own character, each representing so much pain and pleasure, and all of them so often placed and replaced to obtain harmony, all the shades of colour and tone elaborated with such effort, all this, regarded as a whole from those others' point of view, now seemed trivialities 1,000 times repeated. The face that was most dear to him, that of Christ, the centre of the picture, which had so enraptured him when he first discovered it, now, regarded from the other's standpoint, seemed quite worthless. He saw a well-painted, and not even that, for he detected a multitude of errors, repetition of those innumerable Christs, Titians, Raphaels, Rubens, with the same warriors and the same Pilates. It was trivial, poor, old,
and even badly painted, weak and lacking harmony. They would be in the right when they began to say falsely polite things in the presence of the artist, and to pity and laugh at him behind his back. The silence grew too unbearable, though it had not lasted more than a minute. To break it and to appear calm,